and welcome to the Tudor Her Story. Today I am talking to Dr. Tracy Borman on the relationship between mother and daughter, Anne Boleyn and Elizabeth I. Hi Tracy, thank you so much for joining me.
Hi Jess, it's such a pleasure to chat to you again. Obviously we've met in person, but it's nice to be on your podcast, so thanks for inviting me.
No problem at all. So I briefly mentioned in my introduction that we will be talking about the relationship between Anne and Elizabeth. But I thought first we could talk briefly about you. So I thought, would you like to introduce yourself and why you became interested in history?
Sure. So my name is Tracy Borman, and I am first and foremost a Tudor historian, although I have written on a number of other periods. And I am also a joint chief curator at Historic Royal Palaces, the charity that looks after, among other places, Hampton Court and the Tower of London. I'm chief executive of the Heritage Education Trust, which encourages children to visit historic sites. And I also present some TV programmes as well. So history definitely keeps me busy. I became a historian thanks to my inspirational history teacher, Mrs. Jones, in Lincoln. And she taught me history A-level. And really, I haven't looked back since then. She really just lit the fuse for me, and in particular, made me fall in love with the Tudors. So I feel very lucky that I now get to spend lots of time with them.
I've got to be honest, I am quite jealous of where you work. Where you work.
I know, I'm very lucky. I still pinch myself when I walk up the main drive of Hampton Court or over the drawbridge into the tower. It's definitely a shivers down the spine moment on a regular basis.
Absolutely. So I thought when we come to Anne and Elizabeth, obviously they didn't actually spend a lot of time together. But as your fantastic book reveals last year, 3 years was more than enough to bring out a legacy for Elizabeth I.
Exactly. That's such a good way of putting it, because I think one of the great myths of Tudor history is that Elizabeth thought nothing about her mother. She hardly mentioned her. And yes, it's understandable because she was 2 years and 8 months old when Anne was executed. But as you say, that bond had already been forged and it would stay with Elizabeth for life. She never stopped trying to honour her mother, to sort of repair her shattered reputation. And you see that bond from the very beginning. Anne couldn't bear to be apart from Elizabeth. She had her place next to her on velvet cushions when she was conducting her queenly duties. And one contemporary was quite scandalised by this and recorded, "Day and night, she will not let this daughter of hers out of her sight." And I think that speaks volumes for just how close that bond was.
No, absolutely. Because as you say, it's one of the Tudor myths that Elizabeth I does not care about her mother. She more emulates her father. But again, as your book brilliantly points out, there is so much evidence to suggest the opposite.
Completely. There really is. And it's less about the relationship during Anne's lifetime and more about what happened next. And I was staggered once I started the research. It was like the tip of the iceberg. I'd found out a little bit when I researched my book, Elizabeth's Women, way back in the early 2000s. And then I found out all sorts of things, how Elizabeth displayed her mother's emblems, how she almost went to war with France on Anne Boleyn's behalf because this rather critical book about Anne had been published in Paris and Elizabeth went mad when she heard about it. And I think one of the most telling things was how Elizabeth surrounded herself with Boleyns, like throughout her life, but particularly during her early years as queen. You basically couldn't get a job in Elizabeth's court unless you were related to Anne Boleyn. And that really struck me, perhaps more than anything else. So it was such a fascinating journey of discovery. I started out thinking, will I find anything? And then ended up with enough for about three books. So it was an absolute joy writing this one. I really loved it.
No, I've got to say it's one of my favourite books and I recommend it to everybody.
Thanks, Jess. That's lovely to hear. And I know you're a discerning Tudor reader, so that's really nice to hear. Thank you.
No problem. So, as you say that Anne was wanted Elizabeth by her side all the time, was she actually able to spend a lot of time with her through the 3 years of her marriage to Henry?
Sadly not, because royal tradition dictated that when a royal infant reached the age of just 3 months, they would be sent away from court and set up in their own establishment, their own household. And that's exactly what happened to Elizabeth. Towards the end of 1533, she was packed off to Hatfield House, north of London. She was sent there with 50 servants, so not bad for a three-month-old. And after that, Anne could really only visit her quite seldom, because the pressure was on her to conceive again. And in fact, she was pregnant again 3 months after Elizabeth's birth, so about the time that Elizabeth was sent away from court. But this is really fascinating, because Anne made sure that Elizabeth would be surrounded by maternal influences, i.e. relatives of Anne, friends of Anne, women she could trust to help Elizabeth grow up as Anne would have wished her to, and with a very positive impression of her mother. And that really was, I think, pivotal, because I don't know about you, but I can't remember anything from when I was 2 years and 8 months old. But these women stayed with Elizabeth, some of them, for the rest of their lives. So they were constantly shaping her worldview, and in particular, her view of her mother.
Now, I agree with you on that, that I think once Anne did sadly get executed, they kept her mother, Anne's memory alive.
Yes.
Maybe in private once yes. she was yes. sadly dead, but kept that memory going.
Absolutely. They really did. And, you know, Anne chose well. She knew what she was doing when she influenced the appointment of her daughter's servants. And particularly, I'd point to a couple of them, Blanche Parry, her nurse, and Kat Astley, her governess. Both had strong Boleyn connections. Both were very benevolent influences when it came to Anne Boleyn. And both women actually died in service. They served Elizabeth for the rest of their days. So, you know, she was well and truly grown up and on the throne by the time that they passed away. And so it was decades worth of influence from these original appointees that Anne had wisely chosen.
Now, I only discovered this when you did your talk a bit about it last year, and in the book, Anne made some very crucial purchases in her final few weeks as queen. Would you like to talk about that?
Yes, she did. And in fact, the last thing that Anne did on earth was for her daughter, because what Anne loved was fashion. Yeah, she had a very French style, as you might imagine, for a woman who'd spent several years in France. And I think she inspired Elizabeth with the love of fashion that she displayed so brilliantly as queen. And so Anne was unable to visit Elizabeth very often, as I said, but she helped to make up for that by sending regular presents. And those presents were almost always clothes. And Anne went to huge trouble over these. On one occasion, she wanted this velvet cap for her daughter, a beautiful velvet cap with satin on it. And the poor tailor had to go back and forth to Hatfield 3 times before Anne was satisfied that it fitted just perfectly. And so she did go to a lot of trouble. She went to a lot of expense as well. And it really breaks my heart when I look at Anne's household accounts, and that her very last action was ordering clothes for Elizabeth from the Tower. You know, that's the last thing she's thinking of. And this document is still in the National Archives today, and somebody has inscribed it, you know, something like accounts of the late queen. So she died before she paid the tailor's bill for that one. I just find that so poignant.
No, I agree. When I read that, I was in tears. As you know, I'm a really big Anne fan, so I was just
tears.
But I think it also breaks another Tudor myth that Anne was cold-hearted and calculating.
It so does. And she's presented as that so often, isn't she? And particularly by people that don't like her very much. And she's this cold-hearted, quite vicious, self-seeking career woman, if you like. Not that there's anything wrong with being a career woman, absolutely. But she wasn't that vicious character. I think she had to be quite cutthroat at times because she was living in that kind of world. And it was definitely dog eat dog in the Tudor court. But Elizabeth brought out a side to Anne that, you know, we don't often see, a much softer side. She was deeply maternal and absolutely adored the daughter, who really she should have resented if she had followed Henry VIII's path of just being fixated with having a son. But I think partly it's just maternal instinct. Of course, you love your child, or you hope you do. But also it went beyond that. I think Anne, she was a fierce advocate for female power. She was a living embodiment of female power. And, you know, I'm not saying she had the foresight to know that one day her daughter would be queen, but she clearly wanted bigger things for Elizabeth than just being a wife and a mother, which at the time was the only ambition, really, that any woman could have, regardless of status. Marriage was the be-all and end-all. And so Elizabeth went one better. Not only was she a queen, but she chose not to marry. So she ruled alone. And I think Anne would have loved that.
No, I think she would. I see Elizabeth not marrying, you know, obviously generations of trauma, but also as a bit of a, you know, I'm not going to get married, Dad, and that's because of you.
Yes, exactly. Who can blame her, really, given her childhood? Talk about being raised in the school of hard knocks. I mean, her mother's executed. One of her stepmothers is executed. She sees her sister, Mary, make a disastrous marriage and be neglected by her husband, suffer two phantom pregnancies. Other women who are close to Elizabeth die in childbirth. You know, there aren't good role models, but you do get the feeling that Elizabeth wouldn't have wanted to marry anyway, because as she so neatly put it, I will have but one mistress here and no master. And boy, did she mean it.
She did, absolutely. So we're going to jump forward 20 years now to Elizabeth's coronation. And again, I was really shocked at what I was reading in your book. Would you like to describe us some of the, you know, what was in Resurrection for Anne at Elizabeth's coronation?
Yes. So Elizabeth, first and foremost, she modelled her entire coronation on that of her mother. So that was a huge compliment to Anne. She used the same set designers. She wore the same crown that had been made for Anne. The same themes were in evidence throughout. But the most striking thing, as you rightly say, is what was on the processional route. And that was a life-size model of Anne Boleyn. This woman whose name hadn't been spoken. Nobody mentioned Anne Boleyn. Certainly nobody displayed her in any way in portraiture. And then you get a life-size model of her. So this is one of the least subtle things that Elizabeth ever did to celebrate her mother. And I just wish I'd been there to see it. It was actually a sort of life-sized family tree with Elizabeth's parents, her grandparents, and then at the top of the tree, Elizabeth herself. But to so publicly declare that, you know, my right to the throne comes from my mother, not just my father, that was a brilliant and bold move by Elizabeth.
I agree with you. And as you say, I'd love to go back. So if you get a ticket to go back, you're going to have to take me with you.
I'll fit you in my suitcase. Don't worry, Jess. It's fine.
Thank you. So do we know of any physical belongings Anne was able to leave to Elizabeth?
So we do, because the Tudors were very good at taking inventories. And we know, for example, one particularly beautiful thing that Elizabeth was able to inherit from Anne was the Anne Boleyn cup, as it is known today, which is a beautiful silver gilt cup. The best thing about it is on top there is a beautiful falcon, which of course was Anne Boleyn's most famous emblem. And the cup passed to Elizabeth. We don't know exactly whether it was a direct gift from her mother. More likely is What we do know is that, of course, as a traitor, all of Anne's goods were forfeit to the king. So Henry inherited everything that had been Anne's. But when he died, his three children got to select some items from his possessions. And it's interesting because Elizabeth was at the back of the queue for this as the, you know, younger daughter. And so you'd think that she would go for whatever was of value left. But instead, she chose all those items related to her mother, because Henry, much as he despised Anne's memory and wanted to erase it from the face of the earth, he wasn't stupid when it came to possessions. And Anne had quite a few nice objects, so he kept them, and Elizabeth then kept them too. And you can still see the that silver gilt cup in Cirencester, in the beautiful church there in the town square. And also there was a set of tapestries on the theme of a famous book at the time by Christine de Pizan, who was writing in the 1400s. And we would call her a feminist. She was promoting female authority. And her book was The City of Ladies. And it sort of imagined a world run by women. And Elizabeth had a set of tapestries on the theme of the City of Ladies, which had once belonged almost certainly to Anne Boleyn.
Well, I think, again, it's another myth, isn't it, that we're doing some myth-busting today.
Yes, I love humans.
That Anne, you know, not all of Anne's possessions were destroyed. Just that stuff at Hampton Court. I can't even think what they're called. Emblems at Hampton Court.
Yes.
But
yes.
We know that some of them survived.
They did, like Anne's carved oak falcon, which... I'm delighted to say is now under our roof at Hampton Court. It was discovered at auction by Paul Fitzsimmons, who's an expert on Tudor antiques. And he showed it to me at Hampton Court. And honestly, that was definitely a jaw hitting floor moment when I saw it, because I knew that we had some carved oak falcons in the ceiling of the Great Hall at Hampton Court, but it's so high up that nobody's ever really studied them. Well, not for a couple of hundred years anyway. And they were all painted over black, probably to disguise them after Anne's fall. And any falcon that was at eye level was taken down, and we thought destroyed, but clearly Henry missed one. And this remarkable thing turned up at auction. I love the fact that Paul paid £75 for it. He knew it was something special, but nobody else did. And now it's been lovingly restored to its beautiful silver, gold, red, all sorts of different colours were used in the original decoration of this falcon. And it's now been valued at about £250,000. So yeah, it's priceless. It just goes to show how much people now think of Anne Boleyn. I think Henry would hate that.
Yeah, I think he would not be happy if he could see the amount of restoration done to Anne's reputation.
Definitely not. No.
In your words, what legacy did Anne leave for Elizabeth?
So that's such a great question. It's a big question too. I think, though, in a nutshell, she provided an inspiring role model for female power, female leadership, because so often Anne Boleyn is only considered in relation to her fate with Henry VIII. And her relationship with Henry, the love affair that then turns very dark indeed and ends in Anne's execution. But what I loved doing for this book was to just look at Anne almost in isolation, look at her and the amount of power that she was able to wield in the Tudor court, which was truly extraordinary for a woman in that time, and certainly for a wife of Henry VIII. And in particular, her influence on religion was profound. She was a reformist. We wouldn't yet use the word Protestant, but that's kind of what she was. And she really drove Henry along the path of reform and the break with Rome. It was sort of Anne pulling the strings, just as much as the likes of Thomas Cromwell, much as I love him. And so all of this was inspiring for Elizabeth, who then, of course, became the ultimate example of female power and saw through the reformation that Anne had so desired. And I think it was such a testament to her mother that Elizabeth chose as her first Archbishop of Canterbury Matthew Parker, who had been Anne Boleyn's chaplain, a real reformer. And so I think for me that says it all. The great tragedy, of course, is that Anne didn't live to see any of this. I think, gosh, what a relationship that would have been between mother and daughter if Anne had been around when her daughter was on the throne. I think they might have locked horns occasionally, but I think there would have been a formidable double act.
No, I think you've summed it up perfectly. I think you've summed up Anne perfectly.
Thank you.
It's high praise from me, obviously.
I know, exactly. I've seen your Anne Boleyn creations and I've benefited from those. So I know what you think of Anne Boleyn and how much you know about her. So I'm absolutely delighted that you think I did her justice. Thank you.
No, absolutely. And for any listeners that haven't purchased this book, please go purchase it.
Thank you. I've just spotted your Anne Boleyn cushions in the background as well. Cushion. There you go.
And then I've got a handmade portrait of Anne.
Oh, you made that?
My nan painted it for me.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Wow, a family of Boleyn devotees. I love it.
They just go along for the ride of me talking about Anne Boleyn.
Absolutely.
So I will be asking some fun Tudor questions, as I like to call them. First off, have you got a Tudor pet peeve?
A Tudor pet peeve. Well, it used to be that everybody keeps trotting out the fact Elizabeth only mentioned her mother twice, because that's not true. It wasn't loads more, but it was more than twice. But actually, I feel that I've covered that now and I've put that peeve to rest by writing this book. My other pet peeve is, and I suppose it's understandable, the confusion that arises between Mary, Queen of Scots, and Mary the First. And so often people join the two, they make them one person, and then it all becomes incredibly confusing. They're two very different women. Yes, kind of blood relatives, but one's a Queen of England, the other is Queen of Scots, and they don't really overlap very much at all. So I suppose it's just, if your listeners take away nothing else, then yeah, two different Marys, but then I'm sure your listeners are going to know that.
I hope so. It's the Tudors. All I think of when people talk about the Marys is the Tudors, when they
yes.
mix Margaret and Mary.
And Mary, just because they think there are too many Marys. And, oh, don't get me started. Actually, I do. It's kind of my guilty pleasure. I did enjoy the Tudors, but we won't talk about the historical inaccuracies.
No, that would be a four podcast episodes alone.
Yeah, definitely.
Have you got a favourite history book that isn't your own?
Oh, yes, I have so many. And it's really difficult to choose just one. But I would have to go with one that really inspired me before I was a writer myself. So basically, I am Alison Weir's number one fan. She's an extraordinary historian. She's Britain's best-selling female historian. And she's the reason I write. You know, it's thanks to her encouragement that I got in print. I was just truly inspired by so many of her books. I think she's written about 35 books now, but the one that stands out for me is Henry VIII, King and Court, because it's like time travel. It's like you've been sent back and you are witnessing what it was like to live, work and sometimes die in the court of Henry VIII. And it's my go-to. I've read and reread it so many times. It's a very well-thumbed book on my shelves and I would recommend it to all of your listeners.
I love that book. I'm so glad someone's recommended
that
book.
Good. You're a fellow fan. Yeah.
I love Alison Weir.
She's fantastic, isn't she?
There's so many people that are in the Tudor world.
Yes.
You're at the top.
Oh,
Alison Weir. And then Dr. Owen Emerson.
Oh, Owen as well. Lovely Owen. It's a lovely community, I have to say. And yeah, Tudor history, you know, it clearly attracts the best people.
Obviously, I was going to make a joke, but it's not funny. My listeners would kill me if I didn't ask, are you working on any more books?
So I am, and I'm quite excited to say I'm actually working on two books, both of which will be out next year. all being well, next autumn. One is about a very well-known Tudor figure who I might just have mentioned before in the course of this podcast, but I can't say more about that one. And the other one is also Tudor, but about something completely different. And I have loved it. That one is a very short book, but all will be revealed in due course. Suffice it to say, Jess, I'm sticking very firmly with Tudors.
Good. Good. Although I love your Stuart trilogy series.
Ah, well, I'm pleased you mentioned that, because actually when I finished these two non-fiction books, I'm actually going back to fiction. And suffice to say, Jess, and I will let you know, of course, when I can, but I think you're going to be pleased about the subject. So there, watch this space.
Next year can't come soon enough for me now. So that was speaking to Dr. Tracy Borman. Thank you so, so, so much for coming on.
It's been such a pleasure. That has been the most fun half an hour of my week, and also the fastest. I could have chatted to you all day. So thanks for having me.
No problem. Thank you so much.